You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
And catch some, maybe. Well, this is actually part two. We met Dr. Ray Hilborn, a marine biologist, last week, and we started to talk about overfishing and quantities and science and everything. And we had so much fun, we ran out of time before I was able to get to the juicy part. So if you were with us last week, here comes part two. If you weren't with us last week, listen to part two and then go to wpcouncil.org and listen to part one later on so you don't miss it. We learned that Ray Hilborn's originally born and raised in California. He is now, among the things that he's doing, he's a professor of aquatic fishery science at the University of Washington. And I meant in our last discussion, Ray, to talk about that a little bit, the similarities and differences. There are people up in Washington State and Alaska, for that matter, that are just as connected to the fishery as we are in Hawaii. It's sort of pleasant. You must we must be able to relate to what you do a little bit easier than, say, somebody in New Mexico or in Michigan would do.
Oh yeah, I mean, I feel really lucky in Seattle, and I suspect it's here true here, is that almost all the fish I eat, and I try to eat fish three or four times a week, I get from somebody I know. But these are all commercial fishermen, or when I'm really lucky, it's fish that I or my son catch. But,
you know, I tell you why I think that's incredibly interesting, for a number of reasons. First of all, you're only as good as the last fish that I bought from you, if you're my store or if you're my restaurant. So this is why here in Hawaii, anyway, through the fish auctions, the United Fish Agency auction, you almost know who caught the fish. And isn't that amazing now that we have the science available for that?
Yeah, and well, lots of fishermen now are doing direct marketing. Mm-hmm. That they send me an email saying, "Oh, okay, we got this, the following for sale.
Right.
If you want some, order it up." And I think that's great. And I know that there's a lot of people that are finding a business of matching individual fishermen to primarily restaurants.
Sure, there's more and more of it happening here in Hawaii. As you know, we've got this great mixture fusion of food, if you will, of chefs, and we've got some really good ones. There are restaurants now that have a couple of fishermen. And they say, "We need mai mai this weekend," or whatever, and the guys go out and catch it. I think, though, we talked the last time kind of a little selfishly about Hawaii. And I think that it's very interesting that you and others have refuted or debunked some bad science that's out there. It must be very difficult when people are trying to make decisions if they're not getting the right information or they're getting tainted information. Have we sort of panic people a little bit? You mentioned, we talked off the air about something that happened. There was a doomsday is 2048. We're not going to have any more fish. Was there anything that would have really been a base for that discussion or that announcement back in 06?
Well, that calculation was based on looking at the trends in catches of fish stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And catch isn't a very good indication of abundance because many fish stocks fluctuate naturally. A lot of the reductions we've seen in catch in recent years has been because we're regulating fisheries more strongly. And when that paper came out, I actually ended up on a radio show with the lead author, and he was actually a reasonable guy. And we tried to understand why we had such different perceptions about the status of fish stocks. And we ultimately got together and said, "Let's find data on the abundance of fish, not the catch, but the abundance." And we published a paper 3 years later that had a very different picture.
Mm-hmm.
Then it showed where fisheries were improving, where they weren't improving. And, you know, since that was 2009, and since then, fisheries in many parts of the world have gotten better and better and better. And in fact, he's offered to hold a fish banquet on December 31st, 2047.
Yeah,
and,
there you go.
And I hope
we'll be eating the last fish at that
banquet. And we won't be, and I hope I'm there.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that would be my 100th birthday.
Wow, isn't that great? Well, I can tell you something. He just let the cat out of the bag. He's a boomer. And it's sort of interesting because I would imagine that a lot of work that's been done in the past was done for a master, in other words, for somebody writing a paycheck, somebody, in other words, go out and document what I want to hear, what I want to say. And now you're a professor, you teach young minds all the time. Let's talk about the information that's gathered sometimes, who pays for it, and then sometimes how it can bite you.
Ah, well, the fish world is complicated because there are many groups that have agendas. And so, you know, obvious one is the fishing industry. I mean, it has an agenda. It wants to stay in business. And there've gotten to be a number of NGOs that business is scaring people. Mm-hmm. And you know, right now, U.S. foundations and NGOs spend about $500 million a year in the general area of marine conservation.
Yeah, that's a lot of money,
and it employs a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And there are groups that you know, if all the fisheries of the world, in fact, I'll pose this question: let's assume that all the fisheries of the world were well managed, who would suffer?
Yeah.
And the answer is
the managers.
Well, not the managers. Now, the managers still have jobs.
Yeah.
But I mean, academics, we get more research money when things are bad.
Sure.
But a lot of NGOs rely on scaring the public to raise their money. Not all of them.
Yeah.
But a lot of them do.
And I do know, though, Doc, in some respects, the fishery is hungry for not just catching fish, but information about sustainability. And I can say that, once again, going to these reality show guys that we have on, they seem to be pretty real in the northeast and eastern seaboard, that when they reach their limit, that's it. They don't cheat because they know that, you know, they're cutting off their face, you know, they're cutting off their lips despite their face, or whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
So they have that feeling of responsibility to the fishery.
Oh yeah, you know, 30 years ago, the norm was, well, if you deplete a fishery here, we'll just move on to the next one.
Right.
But those days are gone. There is no next one.
Yeah.
For most fisheries, and I think the fishing industry has gotten increasingly responsible in terms of realizing that their business depends upon sustainable fishing. And I think I'm lucky. I work in the Northeast Pacific and a couple other places where that transformation is very clear, and the fishing industry in those places is extremely responsible and really leading the sustainability movement.
When we get a report that shows doom and gloom, who are the people that read it? And more importantly, who are the people that pay attention to what they read?
Well, the problem is that doom and gloom makes the front page.
Sure.
And stories of success.
Oh, yeah, we got plenty of fish. That's not front pages.
But no. In fact, I won a bottle of champagne on a bet with the guy I did this study with who had published the original All Fish Will Be Gone when we came out with our much more complicated story saying, gee, we're doing well in some places, not in others. He said we would make the front page of the New York Times. I said his name was Boris. I said, Boris, doom and gloom makes the front page.
Somebody's got to die.
And in fact, we ended up on page 14 of the New York Times.
If you revive something,
I've drunk that bottle of champagne.
Sure.
And that's one of the problems that the news media only pick up doom and gloom stories. And so that's one of the effort that I and a large network of scientists have been trying to really provide information about what the status of fisheries really is.
You know what happened, Dr. Hilborn, and I think this is important for our listeners to understand. There was a tremendous amount of pushback when the Papahanaumokuakea Reserve was created, because it was going to be something forever removed from a fisherman. And there are many people in the Pacific, and I know that the council's job is to try and interpret for us here in Hawaii what's going on. But let's talk about the value of the studies and what needs to be done in the Pacific, because as you know, these studies that are done by scientists like you and others are the grist for the mill that decides who can catch what. And this is some pretty touchy stuff.
Yes. I mean, do we want to go down the road of talking about these large marine reserves, or do you want to talk about managing the fishery?
Well, I think the large marine reserve is hard to undo once they're done. So now, before this recent desire to expand the whale sanctuary was temporarily beaten back because of science, showing, wait a minute, we maybe not to do this. But can't we do both? Doesn't a scientist like yourself suggest, look, we can manage and fish and protect all at the same time in the same place?
Yeah, that's certainly my perspective, that if you ask, there's a big movement to get 20% of the ocean locked up in marine reserve. And it really evolved, that movement started to build in the 1990s when overfishing really was the norm in many parts of the world. Okay. If you ask me, in terms of protecting biodiversity, if biodiversity be better protected by locking up 20% of the ocean or by managing the fisheries well. Mm-hmm. It's no contest that if you manage your fisheries well, you don't have overfishing, you don't have bycatch of endangered species. And that's in, whereas if you just lock up 20%, what's the benefit? Because you're all you're doing is moving those boats somewhere else.
I was going to say, if you tell me I can't fish here, no problem, I'll go over there.
Right, and if you know, and I always pose the question, what happened if we lock up all the ocean? Mm-hmm. Well, there would be more fish in the ocean, but much of the world would eat just as much. Mm-hmm. It's just we'd end up raising more beef. We would cut down more Amazonian rainforest. It would be an environmental disaster that fish are probably the capture fish are probably the environmentally friendliest way to produce animal protein.
Isn't it sort of interesting the message you get from the fish farming industry, because they want to say that, look, we can put these things in a corral and we can raise them and we can take them out when they're the right size to breed or to eat and there won't be any problem. Let's talk about maybe there was one in just recently that came up again in the genetic salmon. That what if they get into the wild and affect the wild stocks? Are there reasons to fear that?
Well, there's two questions there. One is the genetic modification, and then the other is just the escape of domesticated strains. Mm-hmm. Okay, so for instance, Norway has this gigantic salmon industry.
Mm-hmm. Gigantic,
it's a gigantic. I mean, it's one of the biggest fisheries in the world. It's as big as the Alaska salmon fishery now. And
some of you didn't know that, did you? Just learned something.
It is. Mm-hmm. It's gigantic. It employs a staggering number of people. It produces a great amount of food. It has been a bit of a disaster for their wild stocks of Atlantic salmon. Mm-hmm. That's a trade-off. Farming has been a disaster for buffalo.
Sure.
and the Norwegians have basically made that choice. Maybe they weren't informed about it. In where I live, the Canadians have a big salmon farming industry, but from my perspective, fortunately, they don't use Pacific salmon. They use Atlantic salmon. And when those salmon escape, they don't do very well. They haven't really, there's certain issues about disease and parasites, but, aquaculture is here to stay.
Sure.
The real question is, how do we manage it well?
Well, I can tell you, we hear this all the time. I've done other shows on this. When somebody goes to a market where there's both for sale, mm-hmm. and they take a look at, fresh Atlantic salmon and it's $15, $18 a pound, and they look at a fresh farm salmon and it's $8, $9 a pound, people vote with their wallets. And most of us that are feeding a family, if they just assume if it's in the store, it's okay. And I imagine that the checks and balances system seem to be working out to maybe fish that is bad for us isn't on the shelves or shouldn't be.
Well, there's certainly increase in, it depends on the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, the U.S., it's increasingly rare to find species that are poorly managed. There's now the Aquaculture Certification Council. There's the Marine Stewardship Council. Northern Europe, that's true. Most of the rest of the world, sustainability doesn't really, and issues of sustainability don't influence what's for sale. But the right choice is not a wild Atlantic salmon or a farmed Atlantic salmon, it's a wild Pacific salmon. This idea that fresh is better. You know, a frozen fish that is frozen really rapidly is going to be better than a fish that was kept on ice for 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you can.
Interesting you say that, because as you know, here in Hawaii, we really pride ourselves on the condition of the fish. Mm-hmm. In other words, you come home from a fishing trip here, I don't care if you're a longline boat in the fleet or if you're a weekend warrior, if you're not throwing away ice, you weren't prepared to go fishing.
Yeah.
But let's talk about how science has overwhelmed the old perceptions about what's fresh and what's not fresh anymore. Because you can, like you say, if you handle the fish properly. How does that work in the whole big Pacific? Let's talk about the Pacific for the rest of the time we have to spend with each other. And that is, we know that there's a lot of mother boats out there, and all they're doing is grabbing fish for whatever they're going to use, for meal, for whatever. And there's some of us that like it in sashimi. Can the two societies exist with each other in the Pacific?
Well, the big fisheries in the Pacific are tuna.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that I think almost everything else pales in comparison.
Yeah, we revolve around
and at least until you get on the continental shelf. So Russia, Japan, Alaska, those are fisheries are much bigger than the tuna fisheries. Mm-hmm. But for
talking the cod, the haddock, and
the
all
cod,
that,
the haddock, the pollock, the herring, etc. Yeah. But if you talk the Pacific islands, And I worked in the Western Pacific for several years on tuna. And you're really talking tuna and to some extent billfish and things like that. And, you know, we have regional fisheries management organizations. And they're learning, okay? The science is actually quite good. The science on what's the status of big eye, yellowfin, skipjack, bluefin, et cetera, is generally pretty good. But those organizations still have a long way to go in getting their act together. You have 20 or 30 countries that usually insist on a super majority or sometimes even unanimity. But, you know, the progress is being made. But that's the forefront of getting tuna fishery management working, is getting those regional fisheries management organizations to manage their fisheries.
The words we hear all the time, and I'm sure you've heard this, is yabut. Yeah, we understand what you're doing, but our situation's different. You know, we are different from the whole world. We need to keep catching these fish in these quantities. And then I guess what we need to fold into that is that sometimes there's one point on the globe that everybody's interested in fishing at. And that's what we're seeing more and more in the Pacific, with these mega fleets that catch fish for maybe different types of consumption than us fresh fish guys are after. That's where maybe some of the science comes in and becomes pretty valuable. You can do both, as long as you know when to and when not to do the big major stuff that you talked about earlier.
Yeah, I mean, that I don't think there's a problem in the science being able to provide advice on what you can and cannot take.
Mm-hmm.
But the real problem is who gets to take it and how do you keep someone else, like China's building a really big new long line fleet.
Yeah.
Well, they're going to end up not just in the Pacific, but in the Indian Ocean and maybe even in the Atlantic. But we don't, you know, the 200-mile zone basically said what's in American waters or Japanese waters or French waters belongs to those countries.
Mm-hmm.
But the oceans are still, and the tuna fisheries are still more of a free-for-all. And we haven't got an international agreement yet on how to keep someone else from coming in with a new fishery on one.
Yeah, you know what's interesting, and I've heard this before, maybe you can expand on it a little bit, is that the fish doesn't really know what zone he's in. I mean, you know, you can be at the 200-mile zone, and you have a big eye pile that's at 201 miles, and anybody can catch it. The fish is not trying to protect anything. He's just trying to fish. So how often does that come up in the science of when delivering science to, I mean, you know, management, to stock assessments of, look, we think this fish is here most of the time, but it's really, we don't really know these things.
Well, again, we're learning a lot more about that.
Mm-hmm.
So when I worked specifically on tuna, our primary way of learning about movements was to go out and put a plastic tag on the fish.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the program I worked for tagged 30,000 skipjack in the Western Pacific, and I think we recovered, by fishermen's returns or plant inspections, about 3,000 of those.
Yeah.
And they gave us a good idea of how much they move. And the interesting thing is, most of them didn't move very far.
Interesting.
And
we think they're traveling thousands of miles.
Well, some of them do, but most of them don't. Mm-hmm. Most of them are caught very close to where you tag them. But now we've got a whole bunch of new technologies, electronic tags that actually can record where the fish is as it moves around. Other kinds of tags that give off little beeps, and if you have detectors scattered around, you can actually track the movement of individual fish. So we know a lot more about the movement of fish, and some fish really do move a lot, and some don't move as much as we thought.
Yeah, interesting. You know, a few weeks back here on the council segment, we were talking with a doctor from back in the Eastern Seaboard, Molly Savage.
Oh, Molly!
Yeah, it's a great lady, and we learned about the ahi and the striped marlin tagging project, which has a tremendous, like you say, impact because these are bigger fish. Here's the thing that a lot of people don't get. Maybe you can explain it a little bit. When you talk about, say, skipjack, to think that a skipjack is born in the reserve, in the Papahanaumoku Reserve, and it's going to end up off Makaha is pretty far-reaching. From what I understand, these pelagic or these small fish, they don't have a chance traveling thousands of miles not to get eaten by bigger fish.
Well, particularly skipjack. I mean, the lifespan of a skipjack isn't very long.
Yeah.
But even fish that we tagged and were caught 2 years later, often were caught close to where they had been tagged.
Interesting.
But some of them had gone 2,000 miles.
Yeah.
But, I mean, skipjack, you know, they're food for a lot of things out in the ocean.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that's another thing. You know, we hear of on this program, we've had a lot of the guys from the long-range fleet in Southern California and San Diego and all of those guys out of the landing. And they go out to the bait station, buy a couple of scoops of bait. And that's bait. For us, it's food. Mm-hmm. You know, so we catch a coolie and opello and some of these other fish that people in your neck don't particularly like to eat because they're too oily. We love them. Mm-hmm. You know, isn't that something too? Those are our own fish. They don't migrate. They are part of it. What's the difference between, in science, so people can understand, why is a skipjack, why don't they live longer and why don't they last very well?
Why don't they live longer? Because they basically they grow really fast. And mm-hmm. in general, the faster you grow, the shorter you live.
Is that right?
Oh yeah,
it's bad news for you guys. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Right. And so they've got a lifestyle that is live hard and die young.
Mm-hmm.
And they spend a lot of time feeding. In order to grow fast, you have to feed a lot,
sure.
which means you have to do dangerous stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, if you take long lived species, things that live 50 years,
mm-hmm.
they don't feed very much. They're mostly hiding from predators. Whereas skipjack are, you know, they're feeding all the time, and they're basically saying, I'm going to feed as fast as I can and take
because
the risk.
I'm not going to be, somebody's going to get me.
Somebody's going to get me, yeah.
Well, you know, we all know that when you catch an aku, you got to eat it right away. Their shelf life is not so
yeah,
good, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by the same token, we eat them, and we eat them raw. We eat them, and it kills us sometimes to see these boats out in other parts of the Pacific that are literally taking, you know, all of these fish, and they're going into cans, or they're going into dog food or something. They're, you know, so let's talk about how we can coexist before we run out of time again, because you know I'm just getting to know you, and we're burning up the clock here. Let's talk about what brings you right now to where you are with us. What sort of information are you disseminating now about where we should be looking at managing, better regulating, or managing our fishery?
Well, I mean, if you mean us, you mean the Pacific Council or the Western Pacific Council.
Yeah, I do. And the umbilical that now has us hooked up with you.
Well, I just actually happened to be coming through Hawaii as a break on my way to New Zealand. So they grabbed me for a day. We tend to, everybody regionally tends to get absorbed in their own problems.
Mm-hmm.
And for the last 10 years or so, I've been trying to take a big picture look at what's going on in the rest of the world and bring that perspective here. And one of my big interests is how do we get good science, not just to the councils, which generally have a very good yeah. science process, mm-hmm. but do we get it to the media and the policymakers? And
yeah.
one of the big problems is it's this the gloom and doom stories catch the attention. And so, mm-hmm. you know, the leaders in Washington and places like that tend to believe the gloom and doom.
Sure, and they, you know, some people also say, Dr. Hilborn, that they believe the last thing they hear. So you mm-hmm. you need to get in their ear with the right stuff. So I don't want to say that you're the guy with the lance chasing the bad guys, but debunking some of this stuff with real science is very important, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and the problem that one of the reasons that I've become so prominent in this is that there's literally thousands of people doing good science mm-hmm. out there, but they mostly work for governments, and they're not really that free to say, hey, this thing that was published, yeah. this is rubbish.
Yeah.
But I've been sort of building this network of people who can say that. And, you know, if there's an, I don't know if is BS a legal word on the radio?
Yeah, BS is. Yeah.
Okay, well,
it's called
Brandolini's Law, and that says it takes 10 times more effort to refute BS than it does to produce it.
Yeah, see, that's such a sad thing. And listen, one of the things I learned about Dr. Hilborn, folks, is he's got a very user-friendly website, and I want you to check this out. It's www.seafooduw.org, and it's C, the letter C, not S-E-E or S-E-A. Seafooduw, that's University of Washington.org. What am I going to find there? What's the purpose of that website?
Well, that's part of it is to refute a lot of the nonsense out there. Mm-hmm. So one of the pages on our website is called Myths, and it sort of all fish will be gone by 2048. So it sort of summarizes the story, and then it talks about why that isn't
yeah.
true. Another one of these papers that came out in 2003 that said all 90% of the large fish of the ocean, that is the big tunas, were gone by 1980.
Total rubbish. Right.
So we've got
that other word.
Total rubbish. So we've got a page on that, and then we're tracking recent electronic and print media.
Mm-hmm.
And when something comes out, we've got a network of about 100 to 200 scientists. We say, is anyone who's knowledgeable about this want to comment on it?
Can you join the fight or join in the fray? That's another thing that I wanted to make sure that we looked at. One of the things that I try to do on my regular show as well as this one is what we call the other side of the story. I think that if people in my business, in the media, when they publish an op-ed or something, also publish the other side of it. In other words, I think that people like you are going to come up with your interpretation of something sometimes, but those are after the fact. Do you agree that if somebody's going to write something like we call stink, that you got to put something sweet next to it so people can say, all right, what are the pros and the cons? It's like when you get information about candidates running for office, isn't it?
Well, it would be nice if the media did that. I mean, you've got to realize that there's an enormous number of advocacy organizations out there that they have an agenda. And I had a student who went to work for one of them, one of the American NGOs. And at the end of a year, he'd finished his PhD, and he said, I'm not going to work for these guys anymore because they're only interested in science if it supports what they believe.
Right. And I have a problem with that, too.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what it is that you got to follow the money. There's a lot of these organizations that are dealing with EDs that are in six figures, and they got a lot of people making a lot of money, and they need to get a lot of donations. And the only way they can get a donation is to come up with one of these big shock stories and say, look, this is what we're telling you about. Now, donate to us because we got to tell the whole world this, and you need to help us.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And that's one of the problems is that we've now got in the marine world, we've got a large industry that depends upon things being bad. And even,
have a bad day.
Well, and they simply cannot accept that things are getting better in many parts of the world. So you'll still see, maybe let's say there's one fishery in a region that isn't doing well. Yeah. Well, you'll hear all about that. You won't hear that, 99% of the fisheries are doing just fine.
Yeah, it's like if somebody is rubbishing Wall Street because of all the people that are making money, but they have a 401k that's got full of stock. So, I mean, in other words, follow the money. But I think more important than that is maybe one fast thought about why are some people, why do they write a paper, some people, that is so baseless? I mean, what are they trying to achieve, and what's the motivation? Is it always that they've got a master that wants them to write those words?
No. I think most of them are people who really believe this.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they believe the oceans are in trouble, then they're going to try and make a case that the oceans are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is they move from being scientists to being advocates.
Yeah.
The other is that, it just may, some cases it's ambiguous. There's all sorts of reasons that you get this rubbish, but I think a lot of it is basic intellectual dishonesty.
Do you get sometimes just plain angry because you know what you know and you read something, you say, oh, wait a minute, I don't even know where to begin on this one. This is so full of what?
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Yeah. Well, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you spending a little time with us, and I hope people go to that website again. Once again, you can go see Dr. Ray Hilborn's work at his website. It's www.seafooduw.org, but that's the letter C, the word food, seafooduw.org. Thank you very much for being here.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. That's going to do it for this this week's program. We want to let you know that all of you that want to give us stuff, we love your stuff. And there's a couple of ways you can impart it. One is to drop me a line, themikebuckshow@aol.com. And don't forget to go to the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council website. And it is so interactive with so many cool things on it at wpcouncil.org. Have yourself a great rest of the day in Hawaii, Nate. We'll see you next time on Go Fish. Tight lines, sharp hooks, big bites. Follow and see. See you next time.